The City of Glass, you've been writing for a long time, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah, I've been around the block a few times. It's not a sudden thing. But I hadn't been writing prose. For years I worked as a poet, and I really didn't start writing my first prose book until, 79 or so. So it's really been rather recent.
And, are you a New Yorker?
I was born in New Jersey and went to college here, and I've always been around New York, except for a period when I lived in France for about 5 years in the early 70s.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Columbia during the late 60s, a rather tumultuous time there.
Yeah. I remember almost getting hit by a couple of bricks there myself in the guise of reporting
right.
student disturbances. You were studying English?
English and comparative literature. I stayed on for another year, got an M.A., and then after that left academia and became a merchant seaman, actually, for 6 or 8 months and earned some money, and with that moved to France and led a rather hand-to-mouth existence as a translator, tutor. I worked for a movie producer for a while and managed to stay there for about 4 years and then came back to New York in 74, I guess it was, and I've been here ever since.
Had you studying English, I assume that you decided either to make teaching a career or you definitely wanted to go into writing.
I was always writing, even as a kid, so that was definitely the thing I had chosen. But, of course, there's always the question of earning a living, so I've done all kinds of things. But for a long time, I worked as a translator from French into English, and for years, I made my living doing that.
Now, where? In France itself?
No, well, a bit in France, and then also when I got back to New York, that's what I did. All kinds of books. I started out translating poetry for my own out of my own interest, and then that led to more commercial jobs, prose books, nonfiction mostly, history, anthropology, all kinds of things.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
No, not at all. Neither one of my parents went to college, as a matter of fact. But it was just something that started very early for me, and I kept with it.
Were you writing at,
I was
at an
writing,
early age?
Oh, sure. 9, 10 years old, I was writing stories and poems. And I really never stopped.
Do you remember your first poem?
No, and it's probably a good thing I don't.
A lot of people do. I've often asked that question, and some writers remember vividly their first poem. They can just recite it, and some of them aren't bad.
Incredible.
Well, yeah, it's true.
I think mine was probably pretty terrible, and it's taken me years to get to a point where I'm satisfied with the work I'm doing, and even though it's out there getting published, one always has reservations. In spite of it all.
Well, tell me about your first published work.
The first published work was poetry. And I've published, four books of poetry altogether, mostly with small presses in the 70s. And then there was a period when I was writing a lot of criticism, also in the mid-70s for 3 or 4 years. I wrote articles in the New York Review of Books and Harper's and Saturday Review, places like that to make a little money and talk about books that appealed to me. That's it. One book that I worked a long time on was an anthology of French poetry, 20th century French poetry, published by Random House. That's still out there. That's about a 700-page book with translations by American and English poets. So it's very interesting to put all that together. And let's see. After that, 1979, I think I started writing the first prose book, which is The Invention of Solitude, which is a memoir, I suppose, or a meditation. It's certainly a non-fiction book. And that was published in 82, I think it was. And then the books of the trilogy after that, and then the new one. So that's really what I've been up to.
Well, let's talk about the New York trilogy. I guess City of Glass, this was the first in the trilogy.
Yes, that's
correct?
The first. And the second one will be out in paperback next month, I think it is.
Now, in what way are they a trilogy? Are the characters linked from one book to another?
Well, actually, I call it a trilogy, but you might more accurately call it a triptych. It's three panels, all connected in some ways. I think the themes of the stories bounce off of one another, but they really can all be read independently. The characters don't really reappear, although certain names in the third book crop up from the first book, but really they're not the same people.
You mean names like Paul Auster?
No, Paul Auster only makes one appearance. But it is true that the third book is narrated by a man whose name is never given, so it's left to the reader to decide who that might be. But the books certainly have the same themes, and I think, in a way, they're all the same story told from three different points of view, rather than a continuous saga that goes from one book to the next.
Well, I saw The City of Glass as a psychological mystery. Mm-hmm. Is that that would be an accurate description?
I suppose so. But at the same time, people have made so much about the mystery element that I tend to want to downplay it, because I never thought of the book as a mystery per se. And there's been some confusion about that. For me, it's just a story that uses certain elements from mystery stories, but for another purpose altogether. There are no crimes here, really. There's nothing, no case that's solved, and it doesn't really function that way.
And yet you have a private detective, sort of.
Yes, that's true. I could tell you how the book was inspired in a very curious way. It was a period in my life. I was living alone. It's about 1980, I think it was, alone in Brooklyn. And the phone rang. And the voice on the other end asked me if this was the Pinkerton Agency. Everyone knows what that is. And, of course, I said, no, it's not the Pinkerton Agency. And the next day, the same person called back, asking me if this was the Pinkerton Agency. And again, I said no. But hanging up the second time, I had the sudden thought, what if I had said yes? And would it have been possible to get involved in some kind of case? And that's what triggered off the book. I mean, obviously things changed, but that was really the direct source of the story. It sort of came out of that one incident.
So. Of course, you have a lot of literary digressions, and mm-hmm. You go into the nature of man and the universe and this sort of thing, and they're almost as sidebars. But I think the fact that you pegged the book on a character who is a writer, mm-hmm. a mystery writer, who assumes the guise of a private detective, helps to keep it moving and gives it a lot of body. The next two books in this trilogy, tell me about them. I mean, how are they like or dislike The City of Glass?
Well, in a way, the second one, Ghost, is the most like a detective story, and also perhaps the least like a detective story, in that the character, the main character, is a private detective. At the same time, it all takes place in a kind of fabular world. It's a very short book, only about 100 pages. All the names of the characters are colors. So Blue is the protagonist, and he is hired by a man named Black to watch a man named White. All the events take place in Brooklyn Heights on Orange Street. And really nothing much happens except the detective Blue is watching this man. And little by little, his own identity begins to dissolve. And it's the story of Blue's confrontation with a man who really does very little but sit in his room across the street and write. So that's about all I can say about that one. And the third one, The Locked Room, I believe things open up a lot more. This one is told in the first person. By the end, the narrator confesses that he's the one who's written the first two books. And this is more of a psychological drama, I suppose. It's a story of a young man, I think he's about 30 when the book begins, who had a very close childhood friend by the name of Fanshawe, and they had drifted apart as they grew older. And one day he receives a letter from Fanshawe's wife telling him that Fanshawe has disappeared and that she has to talk to him. And he goes and sees her and finds out that, in fact, all these years Fanshawe has been writing books, but he has never published anything. And this narrator is something of a critic and journalist, similar to the kinds of things I used to do, writing reviews and so on. And Fanshawe has decided that this friend will determine whether or not the work is worth publishing. These were his words before he disappeared, and no one really knows what has happened to him. Well, the narrator decides that the work is not only good, but it's very good, and he sees that it's published, and he falls in love with Fanshawe's wife. He marries her. He adopts her little baby. And bit by bit, the story begins to unravel, as I actually shouldn't give it away, but things get rather complicated for the narrator. And by the end, I think all these stories are about how one can live with a sense of ambiguity and uncertainty in one's life day by day. And I think in the end, maybe the narrator does. And I feel that somehow this third book resolves the three books somehow. Although it's not an equation, there's nothing neat and formulaic about it, but at some level he's able to accept the confusion of his own life, and I think he speaks for all the characters in the three books.
So at some point, shortly, I presume, all three will be reissued in Penguin
yes.
Contemporary American paperbacks.
Mm.
Well, this brings us up to your new hardcover book in the Country of Last Things. It's, of course, easy to say, hey, here's a science fiction book, but it is and it isn't. It does take place in the future, and it follows a Holocaust of some kind. I don't think you ever made that clear exactly what happened, did you?
No, on purpose I left that out. I didn't think that was the important thing. At the same time, I'm not perfectly sure that it is the future in this book. As far as I'm concerned, I'm talking about things in the present. It's a bit distorted, perhaps. It takes place in an imaginary setting. But many of the things that actually happen in this book are events that took place in the 20th century. If you remember, the garbage system that I talk about there is very close to the one in place in Cairo today. The idea of garbage brokers owning a portion of the city and having people work for them. Certain other events, such as the scene in the middle of the book, which I think is a pivotal moment in the story, when Anna Bloom, the heroine, is lured away from her house in the library, and with the promise of a pair of shoes, if you remember this, and encounters what amounts to a human slaughterhouse. This is something I read about years ago in an account of the siege of Leningrad in World War II. This thing actually happened. And in a way, there are so many horrific events that we've all grown up with that we tend to become a little numb to them. But really, I haven't invented too much, to tell you the truth. And in a way, I try to restrain myself from pouring on grotesque details, because that wasn't the point of the book either. In essence, I would say what I was trying to do was to create a character who would somehow embody my best hopes for the world. I know this sounds ironic. To show someone who struggles to stay human in the midst of terrible conditions and catastrophe. And I think she manages to do it, but it's a difficult struggle.
But this is not a vision of the future.
Not really. I didn't really think of that of it that way. Obviously, people are free to read it that way, and that doesn't disturb me at all. But it's really a rather what I might call heightened view of the present, of the 20th century. Not necessarily the American 20th century, but certainly the 20th century in Europe and other parts of the world.
And while all of these terrible things are happening around Anna Bloom,
Anna,
there is a small group trying to survive and trying to be intellectual. I can't remember. Is it Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sam, who's writing a book that is all-consuming for him in the midst of his library, which is sort of an island of almost tranquility.
Yes,
at least
comparatively
for a while.
Speaking.
So while all of these terrible things happen around us, man does try to remain human, or at least a portion of mankind. There's this nucleus of
mm-hmm.
humanity that
mm-hmm.
struggles to go on.
Exactly.
What happens in this library, though? It takes people in, it gives them shelter, but what happens in the book to the people who live in this library?
Well, as you remember, there is a fire at some point later
on. But before that, new administration would come in, and what would happen?
Yes, well, they were pretty much left to their own devices. Every once in a while, this is very sketchily put in the book, but every once in a while, a new government would establish a new kind of law, giving status to one group or another, allowing them to stay there, and then another administration would more or less forget about them. So it depended on the season almost, how lucky you were to be there. And I suggest all kinds of groups there, but I don't really sketch them out in any great detail. I pretty much am sticking to Anna Bloom's story throughout the book and her encounter with Samuel Farr, who's a journalist from the same country that she has come from. And he's trying to write, I suppose, what you would call a journalistic account of what the conditions are in the city and having a difficult time of it for one reason or another.
I can't remember. How did Anna get into the city?
She came by way of a ship, a charity ship, a foreign charity ship, and just arrives on the docks one day, and there she is.
Why couldn't she go out the same way?
Because by the time she decides she does want to leave, again, conditions have changed, and their exit is no longer possible. A fortification is being built along the waterfront, and no ships are allowed to come in anymore, and therefore none are allowed to go out.
Do you have a pessimistic sense about man?
I don't think of it as pessimistic. I just try to be realistic, I suppose, and to be honest in assessing what I see. Perhaps the best way to describe it is in a phrase that comes from Gramsci, the Italian writer, early part of the century. Pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the heart. I think that sums it up. I think that sums up the way a lot of people think about the world. Things are often quite grim around us, but that doesn't give us any reason to give up hoping and striving for to make things better.
In both of the books that I've read, The City of Glass and In the Country of Glass Things, there is this fine sense of madness that seems to swirl around the characters. Was this a deliberate effort or inadvertent? Or can you assess that at all, being the writer?
Do you mean the madness of the characters or the madness around them in the world?
Well, I think both, to a degree. There seemed to be an interaction. There did seem to be a sense of madness among almost everybody in both books.
Both points of view, let me take them one at a time. I think most of the characters I write about are seekers of some sort or another. These are people always looking for some truth, some way to understand the world better. For example, Stillman, the professor in City of Glass, who with really the best intentions launches the most hideous experiment on his son, but he's deluded. He is a madman. Living in New York, as I have for so many years, it's difficult not to keep your eyes open and see what's going on in the streets. And unfortunately, there is a lot of madness and a lot of tragic stuff going on out there. And perhaps it's the influence of the big city. But on the other hand, it just seems that one encounters it all the time, and not just out in public places, but in private as well. People are not as stable and in control of things as they would like to think.
Yeah, there's always this feeling whenever I go out in the street that something is going to happen, something bad is going to happen.
Right.
You know, you're afraid to look at anybody. There's always this feeling somebody's going to come over to you and touch you. Or there was I remember somebody was telling me that his best friend's mother got off a bus at the Port Authority bus terminal a couple of years ago, and a man walked up to her and stabbed her in the chest with a knife.
See.
And she was killed.
Right.
Now, he was a madman, and he just walked up to her and stabbed her in the chest. And you wonder about that, because you see people talking to themselves.
That's right.
This feeling that of insanity around us probably has intensified thanks to the government's determination to use these drugs to treat people and
keep them out of hospitals.
That's right.
I suppose it's not just a sense of danger that I want to embody in my books, but a sense that anything can happen at any time. And I think the facts of our own lives and the facts of history seem to bear this out. You know, we get some very comfortable in a pattern, and we expect certain things to happen the way they've always happened, and all of a sudden something happens and it changes. And I think everyone's life is punctuated by these moments that are really quite devastating or can be quite thrilling. But simply keeping ourselves open to the possibility of abrupt and radical change, I think that's something I'm striving for in the books.
Well, what dark dramas can we expect from Paul Auster in the future?
Well, I've been working on another novel for about a year, and I suppose I have another year to go. And this one will be, again, in New York, but also the West is going to be in this book.
The West what?
Utah. I'm out in Utah for part of the book. And the book is set in the period right around the moon landing in 1969. And so it has a historical context also. That's about all I'll say.
Don't give away too much now. You're living in Brooklyn?
I'm living in Brooklyn.
In a garret?
Not in a garret, no, in a very comfortable apartment that I just moved into a couple of months ago with my family. And we're expecting another child in about 6 weeks, so it's been a busy time.
Well, are you familiar with the work of James Purdy?
Another Brooklynite, yes.
Who literally lives in a garret.
Yeah, he does. I've never seen him there, but...
You climb up four flights, I think, and the eaves, of course, reduce the headroom in his apartment. Actually, it's one room. It's one room with a kitchenette.
My goodness.
And
he's
a
been
bed
there
in the middle.
For years, hasn't he?
He's been there for years, and... But that's all he does is write, even if he can't get it published. He just writes and writes and writes.
But he's a good writer, an undervalued writer, I think.
I think so, and he has a new book of short stories that will, I guess it's out now. Or I don't know what the pub date is, but it should come out. Well, I enjoyed reading The City of Glass and In the Country of Last Things, and I'm going to be looking for the other two books in the trilogy when they're out in paperback. And, Paul, I appreciate that you took the time out to come in and talk to me. I look forward to putting this together.
Well, thanks very much. I was happy to be here.
Thank you.